A23063 and A23036 in the matter of the author of the file for the RGB and BJSON.
Question, these are consolidated appeals. Are we expecting more respondents? Counsel, just you.
I had an email from the guardian ad litem's attorney. It indicated he was not intending to appear. And the children's attorney is not intending to appear as well.
Right.
And Your Honor, I'm counsel for RGB. I do know that Mr. Murakami and I spoke, and I'm going to be taking the entirety of the time for oral argument on behalf of the appellants.
If with those disclosures, then we'll go ahead and unless somebody was going to be watching by Zoom, did you want to wait for that?
I was actually wondering, Your Honor, if it's okay if I could go get some water for a cup.
Oh, I'm just parched. Certainly.
All right. Certainly. Thank you.
Certainly.
Excuse me.
All right, counsel, ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honors.
All right, the case has been called. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument to the court. 5 minutes is reserved to appellant counsel for rebuttal if you choose to use that. Please state your name and indicate which party or parties you're speaking on behalf of before making your argument.
I'm at the Court of Appeals. I'm trying to get it organized.
We have the same thing because we're used to having more space between us.
Very good.
Whenever you're ready.
All right. Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court and counsel. My name is Mallory Stoll. I represent the appellant RGB in this appeal. RGB is appealing two orders that were issued by the district court.
And just if we can state for the record, you're also representing, for the purposes of oral argument, both parties, correct? Or at least you're arguing.
Planning to address the arguments with regard to RGB.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so and just so for our common understanding that you're speaking on behalf of mother, was there anyone that was intending to speak on behalf of father?
No, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
Yes. There are two orders that RGB is appealing in this matter, and the first is the August 2022 order that involuntarily terminated her parental rights on three grounds. I will start with that. The ultimate goal of juvenile protection matters is reunification of parents and children whenever possible and at the earliest possible time. It is the state that carries the arduous burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence that ongoing government interference in the parent-child relationship, which is constitutionally protected, is necessary at each and every stage of the proceedings. Case law has repeatedly recognized that the district court must evaluate each of the grounds alleged in the petition based on the circumstances present as of the time of trial. The government must also prove that despite those efforts, the parents have not demonstrated sufficient progress as of the date of trial to retain their parental rights. At the heart of this case, there was insufficient evidence that RGB failed to correct the conditions leading to her children's out-of-home placement, that she was not in substantial compliance with her case plan as of the time of trial, and that the circumstances at trial were sufficient to establish all required elements for termination of parental rights. Ultimately, rather than focusing on the present, the district court's focus appeared to be on past history that was so significant as to cloud its determination that RGB was presently unable to ultimately reunify with her children. The second order that RGB appeals is the December 22nd order denying her request to be relieved from the order terminating her parental rights under Rule 22. RGB submits, and as is argued in the brief, that had she had effective counsel at that post-trial motion, the district court would have granted her motion and would have at a minimum been able to present evidence at a reopened trial.
Are you saying that we are able to consider the ineffective assistance of counsel claim one that has not been before the court?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I did address this in my principal brief. This court has...
Why is it not being raised for the first time on appeal?
Well, Your Honor, as a practical matter, I don't know when we would ever be able to address an argument like that on appeal when we have a post-trial motion. If we have a termination trial and we argue ineffective assistance of counsel at that trial, you then bring a motion under Rule 21 or Rule 22, presumably. We don't have that here, and I think that's why the case law, not only in Minnesota, but also as set forth in my brief, other jurisdictions have also recognized raising an ineffective assistance of counsel for the first time appeal is appropriate and should be considered and decided by this court on the merits.
Assuming we address it on the merits, your primary argument is that she was representing herself or should not have been? I'm trying to read through how you're structuring that.
Yes, Your Honor. So the ineffective assistance of counsel is not at the termination trial. I would have preferred RGB had counsel at trial, but she didn't. Okay. And she waived it. We haven't argued on appeal that that was an error. It has to do with the ineffective assistance of counsel. The counsel that she was provided at the post-trial motion, where the attorney fell far below any standard of reasonableness in terms of effective representation, something that is specifically codified in Chapter 260C. The attorney that was appointed to her didn't even comply with the most basic requirements of Rule 14 and file any supporting documentation for a motion. So essentially, counsel was left with the same record in addition to the submissions of BJB and his post-trial motion to try and argue why her relief should be granted. I feel I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage with that because I can't give you additional facts at this time either. It's not proper for me to do so. But what I can say is when we look at, and I really think the biggest rub and the one that I want to at least start by focusing on is the second prong of evaluating ineffective assistance of counsel claims. Would she have prevailed had she had effective counsel? And that gets to my record before your honors is somewhat limited, but I think there are a couple of things that are in the record that show had there been effective assistance of counsel, we might not be here today. The first that I would raise is that BJB filed a post-trial motion that was ultimately granted. I do understand BJB's motion was timely filed under Rule 21. Her motion was under Rule 22. She didn't have Rule 21 available anymore. I think the second part, and it's actually, I would call it almost an absence in the argument, particularly with respect to the reopened trial record. And that is, despite mother's attendance at the trial with counsel and numerous witnesses testifying, unless I miss something, I don't see anything in that record to suggest that this 3 to 6 month cycle that the court repeatedly focused on in its termination of parental rights order actually happened. So I think that when we look at that and what I have to work with, at least on appeal, I think that demonstrates that the second prong is most certainly met as well, such that the court's December 2022 order should ultimately be reversed. With regard to the first prong on the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, I'm just going to rest. I cited numerous cases in my brief, the Padilla case, the Nix case, for the proposition of the specific conduct of RGB's trial, post-trial counsel fell below the objective standards of reasonableness. So I don't plan to go into that much further, as I don't really have anything to add with that. So in addition to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, I do want to go back to the underlying termination of parental rights order. I think that where I really want to start, and this was raised in RGB's reply brief, is the non-precedential decision, the TRT case. I see none of your honors were on that panel, but I have tried to effectively raise similar arguments with the court, the district court not focusing properly as it should on the circumstances as of the time of trial. And Judge Larkin's order from the TRT case just hit the nail on the head with regard to ultimately what RGB's argument is. With respect to each of the three grounds, none were proven by clear and convincing evidence, because The court erred by placing far greater weight, far greater emphasis on the circumstances that preceded and led up to the filing of the termination petition, rather than the months leading up to the trial. And given the court's focus and substantial reliance on that, it's simply insufficient to support any of the grounds for termination. And without a ground for termination, this court must reverse. Looking at the TRT case in just additional detail, and I will just cite that is pages 6 and 7 of my brief, there are so many similarities between that case and this one. In that case, it was a second termination of parental rights trial, but the concerns were largely based on chemical dependency, but also what flowed from mother's chemical use in that case. Mother had ongoing criminal issues. She had minimal visitation and progress was limited. She ultimately had the first termination order reversed due to lack of proper notice when the court proceeded by default. But as of that time, in approximately the 6 months leading up to trial, mother was in substantial compliance with her case plan, not only with regard to chemical dependency, but the other circumstances that gave rise.
Judge Allen did address that. You know, his concern and his findings, and I don't have his findings open to the page, but, you know, he expressed the fact that she'd been sober. So that issue, it wasn't as if he didn't acknowledge it, but he was concerned about his familiarity with the file and the fact that it seems like there was a 6 month recurrence. And that was about the time that there was going to be, could possibly historically have been a concurrence. So how do we find that he didn't adequately consider that? That would be his judgment call.
So it was actually Judge Lund that issued.
Oh, I'm sorry, Judge Lund, yes.
But putting that aside, the court, with regard to the current progress, when you look at the order, it was primarily focused on the past and what led up to it. And there were a couple of, I'm going to call them fleeting sentences, to be perfectly honest. And if I'm remembering correctly, I think it's around like page 46 or 48 of that order, where he acknowledges summarily, oh, well, yeah, she completed treatment. Yeah, there hasn't been domestic violence in the home, but they lack insight. And that finding is clearly erroneous based on the court's own findings set forth in the TPR order. Some examples of that I can point to are the fact that social services acknowledge mom is making progress and she does recognize the impact of domestic violence. The concern was whether or not it would be sustained. Well, that's speculative, yes. We can look at past history and see there were concerns leading up to that, but I really want to focus this court on the 5 to 6 months leading up to trial. Mother, for the first time, had engaged in and completed chemical dependency treatment. She was attending AA meetings. She was attending individual therapy. She was sober. She was exercising parenting time. There were repeated references throughout the court's order that mother had been nurturing and appropriate in caring for the children. All of those things are so different than what we had with the prior incidents leading up to December of 2021. And I think that's why the district court in this case ultimately erred. Instead of focusing on, and I will say understandable, having some reservations about whether this is long-term, instead of focusing on the progress, it was, well, because in the past it didn't work, even though she's done all these new things, even though we have a different person before us today, it's just not enough. And I think that
I don't know that the court went so far as to conclude this is a different person. I thought, as I read the findings, granted, you meant use the term speculation. It's always been a curiosity to me that the statute requires the district court to make findings about the foreseeable future, and they do feel a little bit speculative, but that's so in every case. So the court has to draw inferences from past behavior about future behavior. And it's true, you look to the conditions at the time of the trial, but if those conditions are part of a feel to be part of a cycle where you have sobriety, then you have chaos, and sobriety and chaos and difficulty. I mean, the district court focused on the past 4 or 5 months. Those are good, but buttressed it against the periods before. How do you address that?
Judge Ross, so I would say that question really goes to parents 2 and 4 of the grounds for termination. So I'm going to kind of lump that into my argument and in my answer. And here's what I would say. Yes, when we're talking about the reasonably foreseeable future, you have to do some amount of speculation. But I would urge this court to look at prior case law on this when there was a finding and that was affirmed that in the reasonably foreseeable future, there wasn't going to be an ability to parent versus it being reversed. And the cases that I would ultimately look or that I would ultimately point to that are cited in my briefs, we have the RMM case where the court did say foreseeable future, we don't see it there. Well, mother had expressed little interest in caring for the child, had severe mental health issues, and there was testimony those conditions would remain. We don't have that in this case. We don't have that in the findings. We have testimony from adverse parties stating, we're at the beginning stages, mom can do it, but there are reservations whether this is sincere. If we look at the AD case that is also cited in my principal brief, there was testimony received.
You can finish what we're saying.
So I'll just finish with the AD case. The district court received testimony that mother's visitation with her child had diminished, that she refused most services that were offered by the county. And that supported the finding that for the reasonably foreseeable future, the mother would not be able to parent. I'll conclude this part of my argument by simply stating the facts of this case are readily distinguishable from the facts of those cases, in that mother was in substantial compliance with her case plan and had demonstrated change at the time of trial. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Gort. I represent the respondent, Olmsted County, in this matter. As appellate matters go, this is pretty straightforward. We're not here to talk about a contested evidentiary ruling or some issue of statutory interpretation. It really is, as counsel noted, about two things. We're here for two reasons. At first is whether in a case involving parents who have a significant history of exposing their children to the traumatic effects of substance abuse, domestic violence, parental incarceration, instability in the home, chaos, fear, other so-called adverse childhood experiences or ACEs, about which there was testimony in both phases of the trial. A case involving children who manifested harm from that trauma in the form of developmental delays, role reversal, older brother acting more like a parent to his younger sister than a sibling, and an inability to form trusting relationships with peers and adults. Children who, after being removed and receiving appropriate services, demonstrated an ability to heal from those traumatic effects. And then parents whose progress toward correcting the conditions that led to that out-of-home placement was inconsistent and sustained, were never even able to step down under court supervision of the case plan to unsupervised visits, let alone trial home visits. Whether in that case there was sufficient evidence to support the trial court's termination of parental rights.
But you know, CHIPS proceedings are designed to give parents a shot,
correct,
at fixing the problem. And I'll tell you what, I was a bit stunned when I first read the findings of the court. When I got to the final paragraph of Judge Lund's order, there is no dispute that over the past 4 to 5 months, Ms. Bjork and Mr. Bjork have lived peacefully, maintained sobriety, been medication compliant, and completed treatment programs. And it goes on to say, well, but that hasn't been the case over, and it talks about the last 4 years. Focus on that, help me to focus on that concern that we're supposed to look, and the district court's supposed to look at the conditions of the parents and the family at the time of the termination trial. It seems like at the time of the trial, there was 4 to 5 months of what we would have hoped to have always been the case with the family, but wasn't.
Looking over the broader history of the case, there was testimony from the social worker that the parents seemed to do better when they didn't have to take care of their kids. They were able to engage more in programming. And this was even earlier, before there was a CHIPS petition, but some of the earlier history of working with this family. And I know the mother testified when the issue of, hey, are you going to stay with dad? You know, it's difficult to separate issues that dad has from issues that mom has when they're going to be together. And children are going to be exposed to both of their situations. That issue was raised. Mom said, you know, we've talked about getting divorced, but you know what? During this last year, the time that the children had been in placement, and when it's been just the two of us, we've actually gotten stronger. Our relationship has gotten better. So we have two parents who have been able to demonstrate some ability to do okay when they can just focus on their treatment needs, just on their issues, but over time have not been able to demonstrate they can do that when they also have to take on the obligations of being parents.
If that's the case, then why couldn't the parents continue to have some visiting rights? Like, this is a complete termination, right? So if they are doing better when they're not in the home, why not continue with visitation?
Well, it is a complete termination. It is a family placement. And that's addressed in the record, that there have been discussions about visitation that could be ongoing. There's not, from the agency's perspective or from the trial court's perspective, that these are parents who should never have contact with their kids. The hope was that they would continue to have that in a safe and structured environment under the supervision either of the agency or the foster parents or potential future adopted parents, so that there wasn't a desire to completely sever any relationship.
Well, it seems so. I mean, transfer of parental rights would have been another option. And those objectives you're talking about could still be accomplished, but
it certainly could have been. It wasn't raised, it wasn't asked for, it wasn't argued as an alternative to the trial court. There was sufficient support for the trial court's findings. With respect to the second issue, I would note, I agree with counsel and disagree with the guardian ad litem's brief about this being raised for the first time on appeal. I agree that there really was not an earlier opportunity to raise this. This is not a question of, was Judge Lund's decision to allow mother to proceed pro se at trial appropriate? That was never challenged at the time. That's not being raised on appeal. The narrow issue that was being presented is whether that motion that her post-trial attorney filed, who was, by the way, also her attorney during the second phase of the trial, same attorney, was so ineffective that it prejudiced her ability to essentially get the same relief that got, reopening the trial record, expanding the window of time during which the court can consider what progress they've made. Counsel noted that mom didn't have procedurally the same ability to file a post-trial motion that dad did because she missed the time for that. But substantively, factually, she wasn't in the same situation. She couldn't have raised the same issue because she didn't have the same issue. Dad's issue was just to look at the timeline. Trial originally started on May 2nd. Both parents were pro se. Judge Lund was ill, so the matter was bumped out to May 31st. In the interim, Dad hired counsel. Mom didn't. She elected to continue to proceed pro se. When Dad appeared with counsel, he asked for an opportunity to notice witnesses and potentially present exhibits that hadn't been previously noticed. Judge Lund denied that motion during the trial. Mom didn't make any similar motion. She didn't ask for a renewed opportunity to present witnesses, present additional evidence. Dad's post-trial motion was based on Judge Lund's denial of the motion he made during trial. She didn't have such a motion. She couldn't have made the same argument that Dad made, whether it was within the time for one rule or the other. They're completely different factual situations. I'll agree that the omission of a supporting affidavit was wrong. It should have been there. The rule requires it. And if Judge Allen had simply denied the motion on that basis, hey, this is procedurally deficient, therefore you're precluded from raising the argument, we might be in a different situation. You didn't do that. Instead, mother had a full hearing to make the argument that she should be allowed to have the same reopening of the trial record that Dad did. And there was a full decision on the merits. Judge Allen noted not only the procedural deficiencies, but also the substantive differences between what Mom was asking for and what Dad was asking for. So it was properly denied, despite the fact that there was a procedural defect. I would note that the children have been out of the home since April 29th, 2021, about 29 months. They are now 10 years old and 7 years old. They've been out of home for a significant portion of their lives. As noted in the trial transcript, they're doing well. The court properly found that it was in their best interest to terminate parental rights so they can continue healing, continue making progress. Given the type and duration of traumatic harm they suffered while they were in the parents' care, there needed to be a demonstration of the ability to sustain progress over time in order for the court to conclude that the conditions were corrected. As the court is aware and as we've briefed, even full compliance, let alone substantial compliance with a case plan, does not lead to a presumption that they've corrected the conditions that led to out-of-home placement. The social worker summarized it pretty well when he said, the good stuff is really good. The bad stuff is really bad. These do appear to be good people with good hearts who love their kids, but they also are parents who've caused harm to their kids and struggled with trying to make it right. I would note, for example, the way the father described his approach to the case. He said he tried to do everything they said. That didn't work. I went and hired a lawyer and did the opposite. And now just recently, I've been able to get back on track and realize that everyone's really here to help me and they don't want to take my kids away. Was this ebb and flow, this back and forth, fits and starts, one step forward, one step back, two steps forward, two steps back? If progress had continued in a more sustained way, rather than these back and forth approaches, possibly the outcome could have been different. And one particularly interesting pattern also emerged from the testimony. Obviously, life has ups and downs, good times and bad times. These parents, just like they seem to do better when they didn't have their kids to take care of, they seem to do better when times were pretty steady. They struggled in good times and in bad times. The December 10th tow truck incident followed bad news that their parental rights were, or the petition was going to be filed to terminate the parental rights. Mother's testimony was, well, after we got the news of our rights being terminated, we went to the bar and drank and just kind of kept drinking. We were coping with bad news. On the flip side, the November 20th, 2022 incident with Dad followed good news that he was going to get another shot at reopening the trial record, that he was about to be successfully discharged from probation, and that he had graduated that day from a fatherhood program. Whether things were going exceptionally well or exceptionally poorly, response too often has been to drink or use other substances. The connection between alcohol use and violence is clear. Both parents recognize that during their testimony. For example, the court asked the mother, after 120 days of sobriety, you're not worried it could boomerang back? Mother responded, not as long as we're sober. If he starts to drink or if I start to drink, then that's that. And they weren't able to maintain their sobriety. There were more drinking incidents, more notably reported with respect to Dad after that. Dad was asked by his attorney, if your children are returned to your care, what will you do to make sure they're not exposed to domestic violence? Dad responded, never pick up a drink. Of course, he failed to do that. My time is almost up. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. There are two real issues I want to address on rebuttal. The first is the comment regarding time and out-of-home placement. Many of times I hear the state argue that a child is well-adjusted and look at the out-of-home placement time to suggest that to disrupt that would be harmful. But I urge this court to look at that differently. Had the court applied the law at the initial termination of parental rights trial and denied the termination petition, the children could have been reunified with their mother and we wouldn't be here.
But mother is choosing to reside with father.
What we have from the record at the first trial.
I guess what I understand the first trial, but what I'm perplexed about is we're here today and we can't just look at mother because mother and father choose to be together. Tell me how I can look at one in isolation without the other. That's what I'm getting at.
Well, I guess what I would say is that at the March 2023 trial, I'm sorry if I have the record incorrect here, but I don't know how much was discussed about the current relationship status of the parents. What the current status is, I can't tell you guys.
That'll be out of the record anyway.
That's what I'm saying. But what I want to get to is, yes, they were together, but at the time of trial, it didn't require the court to immediately reunify with mother if the TPR petition was denied. And that gets to the fact that had the court applied and held the state to its burden of proof, we may not have been here. Perhaps the district court could have said, I will reunify the children with you, but you need to end your relationship with BJB. I don't believe that was ever asked. And it is something I see often when there are concerns with domestic violence. So the second point I really want to focus on is that progress does not require perfection. When we look at the case law, it's not, have you completed everything to perfection with 100% certainty? The focus is on, have you done enough as of trial, such that the children can be reunified with you immediately or in the foreseeable future? The briefs, my briefs do set forth several citations to the record and just going through the compliance with the case plan, but I believe that looking through the court's termination of parental rights order, the court will see that mother was in substantial compliance as of the time of trial, and not just at trial, but in the months leading up to trial. I've already gone through mother completing a chemical health evaluation, following the recommendations, including intensive outpatient, which is at page 32 of my appendix, enrolling in aftercare at page 37 of the appendix. Mother complied with court orders by submitting to testing, among other requirements in her case plan. With regard to her UA testing, you can see that in page 49 of the appendix. The court noted there was nearly 5 months of sobriety at page 35 of the appendix. She had attended AA meetings. She had a sponsor. That was pages 26 and 40 of the court's termination order. She completed her mental health evaluation and followed recommendations, which included individual therapy. She was medication compliant. That's page 57 of my appendix. She completed, she attended visitation with the children. That's noted at page 36 of my appendix. She signed releases of information and maintained contact with social services. That's pages 21 and 26 of the appendix. There was no testimony that I recall regarding whether mother, to the extent mother was continuing to meet with a domestic violence worker in the months leading up to trial. But there was testimony, I believe, that she was attending that at least previously. Appendix 32, she was actively participating in therapy, speaking with the dynamics in her relationships and the challenging dynamics she faced. She addressed relationship concerns and her other diagnoses. That's page 46. She ensured that the children felt nurtured and had all their needs met during her visits, whether it was dinner, doing homework, or sharing time between the two of them. That's pages 34 and 35 of the appendix.
When, if I could just jump in, when chemical abuse is the real spark of all of the family difficulties, I assume you would agree that sobriety for 5 days before the termination trial would not be very convincing. If you have a years and years long relationship and evidence of alcohol abuse and then violence and abuse and violence, how long is long enough?
Judge Ross, that's not explicitly addressed in the case law, but I absolutely agree with you. 5 days is insufficient, and the name of the case is slipping my mind, but I think it was just from last year from the Court of Appeals, 2 months wasn't sufficient. But then we look in contrast to, I know it's non-precedential, but the TRT case, we had 6 months of sobriety and a pretty lengthy cycle. Unfortunately for the mother struggling with her chemical dependency. So I don't think there's a bright line rule, and there really shouldn't be, because we need to be looking at the specific facts.
No, I'm sure there's no bright line rule. I'm just trying to get a sense of a gray line rule.
This is how I will answer it, as, and I hope this is succinct enough. I think as of the time of trial, even if the court has doubts as to whether it's a meaningful change, but we have months of progress, that is enough to defeat a termination of parental rights based on the conditions that are present as of the time of trial. So again, it's not only progress doesn't require perfection. It's progress that we're looking at. And based on this record and really focusing on the months leading up to trial, despite the history and the context that provides, there simply was not clear and convincing evidence to support any of the grounds. RGB would respectfully request reversal of both the August 2022 order and the December 2022 order and remand for further proceedings.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. That does wrap up our calendar today. This matter is submitted. It will be a decision will be issued in the expedited time frame for these type of cases. This court will now stand in recess to discuss case matters.
All right.